Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of This Expat Life. And I'm joined by another guest again today, one I'm, as always, very excited about. Her name is Diana Nijboer. And Diana is the founder and director of EduMice. And EduMice is an NGO which is transforming education in Rio de Janeiro's favelas. And born in the Netherlands, Diana's personal struggles fueled her passion for education and social impact. And before moving to Brazil in 2010, she spent 5 years in the Middle East as an international HR manager. And at EduMice now, she provides high-quality education focused on social skills, English, programming, entrepreneurship, and employability. These are really skills for the 21st century. And Diana's work empowers underprivileged youth to overcome challenges and reach their full potential. Her innovative approach and unwavering dedication, which I can really see with her as well, make her a beacon of hope in education. And I'm so grateful to have her on the show today, not only because of her work, but also because of her very interesting personal story, how she got to EduMice. So welcome, Diana.
Thank you, Amanda. I'm really thrilled to be here in the podcast.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it. Super exciting.
Me too. I always ask the question to my guests, but I already know the answer. But where are you calling in from right now?
Well, I'm sitting in Rio de Janeiro, just the place I love the most in the world. And this, I call it really my home.
Yeah.
I think I feel, you know, the people from Rio de Janeiro are called cariocas, and I feel like carioca de coração. So my heart is really a carioca, really somebody from Rio de Janeiro.
Yes. And, you know, like we met a couple of months ago, we met for a coffee because we connected on LinkedIn, I think. And we spoke about your work and just a bit of our life journeys. And from the beginning, I could already sense like you are a local. You love Rio de Janeiro. This is really your home. And it's so nice to see that.
Yes. And I think it happened from the beginning. We moved to, I'm not sure if I'm jumping ahead, but we moved to Brazil in 2010 and we first lived in Minas Gerais, in a city of the size of Amsterdam, but really different than Rio de Janeiro. In 2012, we moved to Rio de Janeiro, and from the beginning, from the first day, I was like, "This is my home." Yeah. So yes, no, it's definitely my happiest place in the world.
Yeah. Oh, that's so nice. I share that feeling. And you said maybe I'm jumping ahead, but let's dive right into it, because actually why I invited you on the podcast, and this is what I want to share with the listeners straight away so they know what they're going to listen to, is really that I met you as the founder and director of EduMice, and I have this image of you doing amazing work in Rio de Janeiro. And then during the King's Day party in April, you told me that you were also this high-flying expat in the Middle East and jet-setting around different countries on the weekend and making a lot of money. And I caught myself thinking, oh, wow, I didn't see that in you, in the Diana that I know now. And that really surprised me. So I was so intrigued to hear your story. And then we started speaking more about, well, how you got to EduMice and how it has changed your life and how you're living your purpose. And that is really what I would love to talk about with you today as well, hoping to inspiring my listeners to find their purpose as well. So long story short, can you take us back to where you were before in the Middle East and how your life looked at the time, and then slowly transition into Brazil?
Yes, surely. So my journey in the Middle East starts in Qatar. My husband moved there and I joined him, coming from the Netherlands, really Dutch, and then jumping into the Middle East. And I loved it as well from the beginning, from the moment I hit the ground in Doha, which was in 2005, which was then a very underdeveloped city and country. But I just loved the bubble, and I loved the it was new and it was exciting, and it was you know, it's like different cultures, meeting different people. But of course, I had quit my job in the Netherlands. I moved with my husband. I was never depending on somebody. I was always an independent person in the Netherlands. And then suddenly I was like, you know, I depend on the visa. I depended on him giving me permission to drive the car because that was part of the culture of the country. Yes. So, you know, when I moved there, my friends and aunts said, like, are you really going to do that? Because your husband has to approve literally everything. If I was allowed to work, if I was allowed to have my own bank account, if I was allowed to drive the car. Of course, my husband doesn't have any problems with that. But, you know, that was like, for a lot of people, was a big shock.
Yeah.
Because they all knew me as like this independent woman and, you know, having my job and my own house and all that kind of things. So there I was in Qatar. My English was not so good at the moment. And I gave myself first the time to watch, you know, to watch a culture, to just to look around, to see how people were dealing with each other, especially the Arabs. And I was intrigued in how this culture was so different from the culture in the Netherlands, whereas like the Netherlands is quite individualistic and the Middle East is very, very collective.
Yeah.
So I was looking at how people were dealing with each other, the locals. And then at the same time, I was diving into an international environment that I didn't know of before. You know, it's like, so getting to know so many different people, and especially in the Middle East, where so many different nationalities come together, was super exciting because everybody, the other thing what happened there was everybody was there to work, you know, especially all the expats. All expats came to the Middle East to work and to, and so you connect easily with each other, which was super exciting. And that really enriches my life. And then after 2 months, I was bored. And I was like, I mean, so the first 2 months was like drinking coffee with people, meeting new people, getting to know the city, which was not very big, but you could get lost easily because of like there were no street names. And I was like, so everything was organized so differently. Mm-hmm. So everything was like new and overwhelming. And, you know, of course, I went to a fancy gym and to the swimming pool and nice hotels. And we had very nice brunches with people. And but after 2 months, I was like, oh my gosh, I cannot do this for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So I got out and I spoke with many people and with people who were in recruitment. So I got a very nice and interesting job in a consulting engineering firm, a British one. I had two options to work for a Danish international firm or for a British. And then one way, the other way, I thought that, okay, you know, Europe, we have all kinds of same culture. And how wrong I was, because when I started working for this British firm, I discovered a completely different world. And what I thought in, you know, in the Netherlands, you know, quite well, okay, if you do a certain thing, if you react in a certain way, you are successful. And in the Middle East and in working for a British firm, everything that I knew was not working. So I got an identity crisis, you know. It's like, okay, but who am I in this world? You know, it's like, and what do I think about my own culture? So I discovered the Dutch culture, that we're individualistic, that we're task driven, that we are, that we have this work ethic. And there I needed to relate differently to people. And that was interesting and challenging. So I knew, how can I say it? I can almost say like it was kind of a rebirth, you know, or like discovering, okay, what's my own culture? Because if you live in your own culture, you don't know what your own culture is. You only start discovering your culture if you move abroad, you know, because then you're exposed to something new, and then you have your own, the software of your mind is driven by the culture you come from. And then you have to, then things are happening and you have to assess it differently. And then you have to discover for yourself, but what do I think about it instead of what is my culture determining? And so that was a very big process. So I started working for this British firm, and then I got the opportunity to, we were based, my job was based in Doha, but our main office, our head office for the Middle East was in Dubai. And then I was asked to support the Dubai office in the reorganization of the HR department. So I flew every Saturday night. I flew to Dubai, and then I stayed in a 5 to 6 star hotel for 2-3 nights, and then I flew back to Doha and worked 2 days in Doha. did that for almost 5 years, which was in the beginning, oh my God, in the beginning it was like, you know, flying out and then being in the first class lounge, and then, you know, it's like having these hotels and beautiful and lovely dinners with people and food and working many hours. But at the end of the 5 years, I was exhausted, first of all, because over the time I discovered that, you know, you get used to a first class lounge, you get used to a fancy hotel, you get used to a fancy dinner, and becomes normal. But there was another thing as well. It's like, so the Middle East is a desert, and where is, and especially in that time, and Dubai was fancy and that was perceived as an ugly duck, but it was all a desert. And I loved, to be fair, I love the desert, but after, you know, after 2 months you want to go out, you know. And even me flying out to Dubai was not relief, was not giving me any joy anymore, because as I said, you know, this first class lounge, every week you're there and there's always a delay, and you know the drill. So we needed to fly out every 2 months, like, okay, leaving Qatar, leaving the Middle East to go to nice places like Sri Lanka, India, Malaysia, to visit all those places, to renew your energy, to get new energy, to go see all the things. Then being in that way, one way it was very enriching, but still at the same time it just was very limited.
Exactly.
And that was caused by, first of all, it was kind of caused by the nature, you know. I loved nature in Rio, which is abundance, you know. It's like you walk out and you have huge trees. Yeah. And in Qatar and in Dubai you have the beautiful parks, but they're all artificial. But as well that you're all in the same boat, and the conversations were always the same. It was always driven by work.
Yeah.
So I loved every minute. I don't regret it, because I think I needed it as well. I was it gave me a sense of success, you know, being successful in a kind of environment there that I had only dreamed of before. And having experienced it, you know, it's like having the experience of knowing what the first class lounge, and I'm quite sure that a lot of experts know that, but I was not an expert before. And being in a very high perceived role where we had many changes in the business, guiding the business to change in strategy, hiring high profile people, and at the end, of course, in the period as well, we had the economic downturn because of the construction world collapsed in that period, and then having this transition again, which was all very interesting and had formed me as a person, but I was empty as well at the end. And I needed to compensate.
Yes, I want to talk about that. Yes, because I've been listening to your story. I'm like, wow, like so many parts, I recognize them. I mean, although as diplomats, we do not standard fly first class or business class. It's only occasionally. But I think a lot of the high achieving expats who are listening recognize a lot of themselves in your story. So, you know, the success that you have, the rewards that come with it, it's this prestigious life. Like, it's not everyone gets to live a life abroad full of luxuries and travel and meeting interesting people all the time. Like, it's stimulating in a way. But I just heard you say, like, it was also, you felt empty and you were compensating. So maybe in hindsight, because maybe at the time you weren't really aware of it, how were you feeling? What was the consequence of how you were feeling, and how were you compensating that void?
Yes. So initially, of course, you feel recognized for your qualities, and initially you think that's about you as a person. At the end, it is just a job. And so what did I do to You know what? In the beginning, I didn't know. I was feeling going into the empty space. But what I knew, I started drinking more. I got a little bit rid of my discipline to run. And besides that, you have there to go and run in the gym, which is not very not very a very interesting surrounding. So my compensation was actually initially like drinking more. Buying expensive clothes, buying expensive jewelry, going on expensive holidays, having, you know, the exorbitant lunches, especially in the Middle East where you have the Friday brunch, which is always like, you know, we have a lot of food and a lot of alcohol. And so when, you know, when that becomes like kind of new routine and then there's something inside that creeps up, and it's like there's something, you know, it's like the body was giving signals that wasn't going well with me, with myself. I was really exhausted, and then you try to fill this void that you have inside of yourself, and so that was going with buying expensive clothes, holidays, doing luxury, you know, having a luxury life, but that didn't feel the void.
No. So it's basically finding distraction for or filling that void, but like with external things that are available to you there. At what point did you realize that, okay, maybe this isn't working for me, or this is a void I cannot fill with these things? Or did you even recognize that point during the time, or was it more afterwards?
No, because before we, I you know, it's like it builds up. You know, it starts with some small things. It starts with, you know, in the beginning, it's out of awareness. You know, it's like this creepy feeling inside of, at least inside of myself, it's like this void, which is in the beginning, it's a small void. And I first started doing it's like going more to the gym, having more massages, having, you know, it's like having, trying to take care of myself.
Yeah.
Going into more healthy eating habits, but still that could not fill this void. And at the end of the period that we were in the Middle East, and before knowing that we would move to Brazil, I took a course. I took first a course in coaching, and then I did a leadership course. And that leadership course was not about, okay, you know, how do I have a good conversation? It was more discovering yourself and, you know, where am I right now in life and where do I want to go? And actually in that course, we had a super interesting exercise. And in the first week of that course, we had an exercise where we had visualization. And in that visualization, I saw myself working with children. But we didn't know. I didn't know at that moment in time that I would move to Brazil. But I saw myself working with children. I had never worked with children before. And so I saw myself with a lot of children, and they were colored children. That was the only thing. And it was green. But, you know, it could have been Asia. It could, but I couldn't picture where it was. And so that happened in the first week. And it's very intriguing because I don't have children of my own. I had never worked with children before. I had never had the desire to work with children. Mm-hmm. So that started there. And this leadership course was absolutely to try to fill the void, you know, to discover who am I right now, where do I want to go.
Can I, before we go into this transition phase, can I ask something about the void? Because you say like you wanted to take care of yourself with massages and healthy habits again. So there was something already inside of you that recognized, oh, this isn't going the right way. How did you experience that void? Did you recognize it as a void back then? Or how was it coming out of you?
Yeah, no, I definitely discovered that. I find it quite hard to formulate, like, okay, it's like, you know, how did I recognize it? But it was like a restlessness in myself and this unease feeling, and not, you know, not knowing anymore who I am within the circumstances. And as well, it's like, you know, initially it's nice to buy nice clothes and to have a fancy car and to go on holiday, but then it doesn't, that as well didn't feel anymore my emotional bank account, so to say, but I didn't know that word by then.
Yeah,
I didn't use it, but it was like, you know, my financial bank account was great, but my emotional bank account was just completely bankrupt.
Yeah.
And it's then this very uneasy feeling, and going after, you know, after everything what I had done before that didn't work anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
For me.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you know, if you cannot be with yourself anymore and you feel you're always like on the run from one thing to another thing, I think that was what was going on. I was on the run from one thing to the other thing, and it was never enough. Mm. And it was all outside of myself, and that couldn't fill. That couldn't satisfy me anymore, fulfill me anymore, or give me peace of mind anymore.
Yeah.
So I was literally actually kind of running away from myself.
Yeah. Wow. This is something that I recognize a lot in my own journey as well, because I was always on the go and traveling and living abroad, and it was distraction for me, but I didn't realize it at the time. It was just easier to be on the move, to stay in motion, than to sit with everything that was going on inside of me and look at that void, and to really assess what I was going to need, because that's difficult work. It takes a lot of inner work. I think a lot of people will recognize something of themselves in your story, because I think a lot of people aren't fully aware of that maybe they have a void as well, or they are not living 100% fulfilled in their lives, but they will recognize some of the things, like distracting yourself with travel all the time or buying clothes. I did that too. alcohol is definitely one that I hear and see a lot all the time. Maybe it's food, or just going out with people all the time, or buying other things. Yeah, I think it's so common in our society to just find distraction for something. And especially as an expat, when you don't have that base around you, your own culture that you are rooted in, and everything is up in the air, and you rely more on yourself. Like, who am I? Like you're saying, the things I thought were working aren't working anymore. And so then you fall back, you try to hold on to other things to find some grip, I guess, and to have that dopamine hit. So, I really enjoy listening to your story, because I recognize so much of it in my own story, but I also know it from my friends and from some of my coaches. So you had a big turnaround in the leadership program. Some other people hit a wall at some point, you know, they find too much distraction, it's not working out, they go into burnout or whatever. It seems like you were there at the right time doing this course, and you got this visualization, or this, I don't know, struck by lightning, perhaps a vision from the universe of where you wanted or where you should be going. How was the rest of your story? Like, how did you transition from having this big financial bank account and zero on your emotional bank account to what you're doing now?
Yeah. So going back to this first visualization exercise, we did another one. And that was like in the third part of this course, which was taken, like there were four parts over a year. So this was in the third part. And then I already knew I would go to Brazil. And I had the same exercise, but I had the same image. Mm. And then I was encouraged to start planning a project about, okay, when you go to Brazil and then, you know, start something working with children. I was like, no, not me. I was like, no, you know, like, no, you know, I had not the courage, and I couldn't visualize it at all. Actually, I had this visualization, but I could not see myself doing it. But anyway, we moved to Brazil. We lived in Uberlândia of all places, which is like, it's a lovely city, but it was not so much to do for me. So what did I do first? I started, I was an athlete in my youth. So I started running and a lot, and which was fun. But again, it didn't feel the void. I was still feeling kind of restless and being, you know, being as well, moving to Brazil, not speaking the language initially, being in a city where there's like no expat life. That was challenging, of course. And coming from a background of sports, I first tried to go and feel try to find my fulfillment there, but that didn't work. And then I had the luck to meet somebody who was working in some of the communities in Obalanje. So I visited some of the communities and I was intrigued about, I was grateful that the people were allowing me to, you know, to meet them.
Yeah, can you, I know what the word community means here in Brazil, but can you maybe share for the listener who isn't aware of this meaning?
Yes, I've got two words, right? So we have the word favela, and we have the word community. They are kind of intertwined, but nowadays, actually, I use more the word favela, which is as well by the Brazilian government recognized as the word to use instead of say communities. Internationally, it's seen as slums. Here we say favela is an informal settlement. It is the houses are built on ground which is not from them, but the houses are from them or they rent houses. But they're like underprivileged living circumstance for the people who live in favelas.
Yeah.
So it are in general the lower social classes, people with very low income families, informal jobs. People with low education.
Yeah.
And in general, so to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a lot, there are like a lot of resources are lacking. The government is not so much involved. So you have to see, it's like, for example, the lack can be of lack of electricity or there was like literally lack of infrastructure. Everything was missing.
Yeah.
So I hope that's kind of short enough to have explained. So I went there and I saw this poverty and I saw big families with no resources. And I was just intrigued, okay, so what's all this causing? And then we moved to Rio de Janeiro in 2012. And when we moved to Rio de Janeiro, I was like, okay, I'm going to find my way in the favelas. So that's actually what I immediately did, because I was looking for a job in the HR field, but Brazil is very challenging. As Brazil's known, Brazil's not for beginners.
Yeah.
Brazil's not for beginners. And instead of like, okay, you know, I'm going to really work hard on getting this job, which most of the people had already warned me, oh, that's going to be very challenging. It's like, no, I'm going to see what I can do. How I can be of service of other people. And so I entered the favelas and started volunteering with different NGOs and started teaching. Started teaching English, started working with children. And that was a very steep learning experience, because those kids come with issues. And that's not their fault, but their circumstances are so different than for especially for people from the expat community, where most kids go to private schools and good private schools and have a lot of support. Those kids don't have the means to go to good schools, and there's no support. So there were a lot of issues. I forgot to tell something actually, because something happened before we moved to Rio de Janeiro in 2011, and I think that was actually something that has given me courage. In 2011, I was diagnosed with cancer, and skin cancer, and it was like, you know, at the moment in time when I was diagnosed with skin cancer, it was like they didn't know if there would be and I always get this word wrong, metastasis, if there would be in my lymph nodes, yes or no. So that was a life changer. You know, it's like moving abroad was a life changer, a big one. But having been diagnosed with cancer and not knowing if you would survive, because if it would be in the lymph nodes, I would not have been here anymore. So that gave my life a different perspective.
I was actually just wondering, like, because before you were saying that you saw a visualization of you working with the kids and you thought, okay, that can be me, but you were like, no, not me. Then you saw poverty in Uberlândia and then you moved to Rio and it's like, okay, I'm working in the favelas. And I was, when you shared this story, I was already thinking, oh, there is a gap here. Like, how did you move from A to B? Now I know what had happened.
Yes, that's the gap. I think that is... that took away so much of my, I was always worried about the future, you know, is there still being like, no, I need to have my own earnings. I need to continue with my career. I need to make sure that we will financially be good. So there was like all those future fears. Yeah. I was carrying with me, and I think especially coming from a Western background where we have like, you know, being, oh, your retirement plan and this plan and that plan and, you know, all those kind of things. And I was hooked by that. And then when the message came from, okay, so now you have cancer and no, you have to go to this hospital. You cannot go to another hospital. No, this needs to happen. And I was like, okay, I'm not in control. Yeah. And that was another thing. I always tried to be in control of everything, which is as well, especially in expert life, impossible. But, you know, it's like sometimes we try to be in control because it gives us security of a feeling of safety and security. Yeah. And when that message happened, it was like, okay, I'm just not in control. There's like, I don't know, maybe I will not be here in a year anymore. So that put everything in a different perspective. And that was a roller coaster, but that gave me courage.
Yeah.
Because when, you know, so I went through the full process and got my surgery, and then you have to wait. And then it's like, but when the message came, okay, it's clean. You know, you will be in control for 10 years, but it's clean. There was still the risk that it could, you know, that could reoccur, but the risk was small. And that has liberated me. That sounds really weird, but it liberated me in being occupied about the very far future.
Yeah.
So that was 2011.
Yeah.
And then 2012 came, and then, you know, it's like, and then we moved to Rio de Janeiro, and I was like, I'm going to be in the favelas. I knew that, but still, I still had not the idea I would create my own NGO.
Yeah, so how were you able, like you had this visualization, and I'm sure other people have that too, I have that too, but not everyone honors it or accepts it or takes action on it. So apart from like getting that courage through that life-changing event, what made you feel like, okay, this is the visualization that I'm going to make reality? How did you feel that was your future?
I think that happened after... So 2012 was the first time I entered the favelas in Rio de Janeiro, which are completely different than in most cities in Brazil. Because in Rio, the favelas in Rio are rich and poor lives next to each other.
Yeah.
So the favelas where Edomais is like, you know, it's within less than 5 minutes you're in a favela and less than 5 minutes you're outside the favela. And as soon as you're outside the valley, you're in Copacabana or Ipanema.
Yeah.
And so rich and poor lives like, it's like next door, which is, it's in very different than many cities. It's more separated.
Yeah.
But when I came into this favela, there was a very strong feeling, and I can still not explain it, but the first time I entered this favela, I was like, okay, in Portuguese, isso é minha terra. So this is this is my ground. This is where I belong. Mm. And that overwhelmed me, you know, that came over me. And that was very strong. And I still have it. I still have, and I don't live in the favela. But I, you know, it's where I belong, where I need to be to do what I do.
Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. Okay, so take us to the next step. You got into favela, you started volunteering there, and then...
Yes, yeah. So I was running some programs for another NGO, but I started volunteering as well in this favela with a philanthropic organization. And I started working with the poorest of the poorest. on Saturday mornings, the poorest of the poorest. They were still living in woolen shacks, hardly any food, hardly any attention of broken families, you know, because most of them are broken families, especially in the poorest of the poorest. Lack of everything. But it's like, they were, every Saturday going to work with those kids, and what we did was singing and drawing with the kids and giving them a sandwich and giving them a lot of attention. And I felt, it sounds to me really weird, but every Saturday morning when I came down, because we're just like, you know, you go to the to the highest point in the mountain, because that's where the poorest people live. And every Saturday when I came down was like, I needed to cry. And I was like, I was not crying because I felt sad about those kids, but those kids gave me something, and I couldn't, and I still cannot explain it, but it was like, there was something healing inside of me that I was like, I felt becoming complete by doing what I was doing for those kids. And, you know, and it was very simple, you know, we went there, we sang songs with the kids, we were drawing, we were reading things with the kids, we were giving them food, and then, you know, after a couple of hours, you go away. But that gave me so much joy, and it was something, those kids needed so much physical attention. They needed to have a hug, they needed to be with you. And I just saw the need of that we as human beings need to be with other human beings, and we need attention. Yeah. And we don't need, at least, okay, for me, let me speak for myself. I don't need those fancy clothes anymore. I don't need those fancy holidays anymore. The need for connection is, it's all replaced by the need of connection and being able to contribute something to somebody else.
Yeah. You mentioned the word that healing, that the kids healed something inside of you, something so profound. And I don't know if this is too personal, but the attention and the connection that you found with these kids by, you know, giving that to them, was that something that maybe you also lacked when you were growing up? And this is something that you then recognized with these kids.
So yes, that's a personal question. We didn't start with that, but I grew up in an adverse region. I have an adversary childhood experience. So I grew up in a dysfunctional family where there was lack of attention, lack of connection, lack of physical recognition. So I definitely, that has definitely, so that was definitely helping myself in the person who I needed to become to be able to give and to do what I do now. So with hindsight, I think that was necessary as well for me to see how I can make a difference in the lives of those children. And those children have healed me basically because of their need of this physical contact, their attention, being able to bring joy to them. They brought so much joy to me. It's like, it sounds simple, but as of today, I'm quite convinced that a lot of people don't know anymore how to give this kind of connection to each other.
Yeah. Well, I have goosebumps when you share this, and it's like the cycle was completed, but in a positive way. Like sometimes trauma goes through generations, right? But the opposite is also possible. So by you doing some of the work and being able to give back to the next generation, you're healing yourself, and they also get something in return that they can then pass on again. It's really beautiful. And then the next step, you thought, let's just start my own NGO.
It's like, it was not really planned, but there was, so I had designed some programs for another NGO, and there were changes in that NGO, and I was like, I couldn't live with that. And then I was like, but wait, you know, I know what I can, I know how to recruit volunteers, I I have a passion for education, because education, next to the fact, you know, it's like growing up in a dysfunctional family, but education has helped me so much. You know, it's like you get more opportunities if you have a good, if you have a bachelor and a master degree, and that would not, you know, if I would not have had them, I would not have had the opportunity in the Middle East. Yeah. So this realization how education was crucial as well for me to transform my life in becoming a different person and discovering my capabilities, which I definitely needed before I could move on to create my own NGO. I don't think if I would not have had the experience of living in the Middle East, by being discovering how capable I was and to work in an international setting and in an international high-ranked profile position, I'm not sure if I would have been able to do what I do as of today. And of course, and cancer helped. I'm going to say that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it literally did. But that was as well realization when those changes were happening. I was like, wait, but you know, this cannot go to waste. So, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to create my own NGO. That's how it started. And I didn't, it's like, I think going back on like that in the past, I was so much focused on the future and on the retirement and like, you know, all kinds of I can say it in Dutch, we have a phrase about beer op de weg, spins van je hoofd. I don't know how to translate that to English at the moment.
But I also don't know, but you see obstacles on the way, right?
Yeah. Exactly, yes, yeah. Obstacles on the way. And they were gone. You know, there was like nothing could stop me. There was like, yeah. I was like, there was such a strong feeling in me that I just needed to do it. And it became my calling forth. It was like, nothing could stop me. And that's how it happened. And yeah. It's not easy to create an NGO in Brazil, I have to say.
No.
It's not easy to create your own business in Brazil anyway, but you know, it's like Brazil's not for beginners.
Yeah.
The obstacles are huge, but it didn't feel like that, you know. And in 2016, I worked so hard to create Edomize, and I worked more as much as I did in the Middle East. But I didn't feel exhausted, you know. In the Middle East, I was like, I had no energy anymore. Everything was gone. And here it's like 60 hours or more, and I was
still not enough.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Oh gosh, I recognize so much of myself in you with some profound events that were inherently like bad, but that shaped your life in a positive sense, and that give you like a driving force that you're unstoppable. Like those obstacles, you'll jump over them. I recognize that a lot. It's like a strong force that makes you just go get things and get things done. Occasionally you do have to take care of yourself that you're not working too much. This is a note to myself. But this is really a driving force that you can change your own life and other lives with it as well. This is amazing. I'm also looking at the time. I can talk to you for hours, and I know we do that because we sometimes meet for coffee or dinner. Can you just maybe share a little bit, if you look at where you are right now, you know, feeling so fulfilled, I think, because I'm feeling in your words, but I think that's how you are feeling now. And if you look back at the Middle East experience, I love that you said, without that, I couldn't have done any of this. So it's like, it's still part of you. You're using it. But how is everything differently for you now?
Yeah, I'm just going to see, because my battery's going low, and I'm sorry.
No worries.
Why this happens? Let me see. It's connecting.
Great.
Yes, exactly. It was like, oh my gosh. Okay, so can you just repeat the question, please?
Yeah, so if you look at your where you are right now and how you're feeling and feeling this passion and being so driven by it, and compared to how you were, like, what is different for you now? And maybe actually, to make it a little bit more specific, what tips do you have for other people who are maybe stuck in the story that you were in the Middle East, being tired and exhausted and filling the void? How can they move to where you are now?
Well, so remember that this emotional and financial bank account. So my emotional bank account is just like it's so rich, and I rely a lot on my husband. So and I feel shameless about that. I feel good actually. I feel good about that. So
yeah.
But coming back to your question, I think. You know, it's a self-discovery. You have to take steps to discover. If you feel the void, go out and discover what you need, what is lacking, and you can only discover that by experimenting, different things. You know, so that you feel fulfilled, and it's this fulfillment feeling. You don't always need to have a calling for it. I know Edomite is my calling for it, but you don't need to have a calling for it, but you need to have fulfillment. And if you don't have fulfillment, you feel this void, and that's eating you from the inside out.
Yeah.
So I think you have just to experiment and see what is working for you and try on. And if it doesn't work, okay, don't think, okay, you know, I have to continue because I started this. Stop it. You know, it's like, of course, you have to try, you have to give it time. But it's, well, if it's not working, stop it and try something else, because you're worth it, and you have this investment in yourself to try different things.
Yeah.
To discover who you are in a different environment, because as an expat, and especially when you move around a lot, you have to invest all the time in your connections. You have to invest in your family. You have to invest so much. So give yourself this space and time to discover what's working in a new environment, because what works in place A might not work in place B or in place C. And so give yourself this permission as well.
Yeah.
But a couple of other things, I think at least what works for me very well is discipline. So we are both runners, right? and one of the things that is for me is like, I know when I'm not okay, when I fell off the wagon, if I don't, you know, if I don't sport regular, there's something going on. So it's, well, listen to the things, if you know, if something is hindering you or what you do normally, and then suddenly you stop it, then there's something going on.
Yes.
And you want to discover it. So the discipline thing, and the courage thing, you need to have a lot of courage. And we, as expats, I think we all have it, and we need to have it. I would say as well, start journaling. So write about, you know, about your feelings and what you have done to try to see how you can fulfill yourself. And embrace what's important for you. Don't look into what other people do and think, oh, I need to do this or I need to do that. Because I think, especially in the expat world, when you're in a certain setting, we want to belong, and we try to adapt ourselves to a certain group. But be yourself.
Yes.
And I think that's a very important thing.
Yes. Well, I 100% agree with everything that you said. Taking action is so important. Give yourself permission to explore, to experiment. Read the signs of your body, of your habits. You know, like, I love that one, especially I'm falling off the wagon, actually, because I haven't exercised a lot in the last 2 weeks. You were already wondering, Amanda, are you okay? Because you didn't see me on Strava. So yeah, read the signs of how you work, and if something is differently, then use it as a check-in on yourself. I really love that one. Diana, this is amazing, and I'm sure so many people will be inspired by your story and might be ready for some more action. If they want to know more about your work and about Edomize, where can they go and what can they do? How can we support you?
Well, thank you so much, Amanda. As well, I loved this experience. This is the first time I'm on a podcast. So,
nice, you're doing amazing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. So where can you find more information about Edomize? It's on our website, so www.edomize.org. Mm-hmm. So that's on our website. We are on Instagram, which is Edomize, at Edomize Rio. We are on LinkedIn.
We are.
We are on LinkedIn, and Amanda's helping with that. Yeah. So that's as well where you can find information. And I think that's the easiest. And if you want to, you can get in contact with us as well by sending an email, which is info@edomais.org. And Edomais, let me spell it.
Yeah.
It's E-D-U-M-A-I-S, and it stands for More Education.
Amazing. I will add all of those links in the show notes. And this is amazing if they want to have more information, but let's make this a little bit more concrete. If people want to help, what can they do after hearing this
Thank
podcast?
You. Yes. So one of the most challenging things actually to run an NGO is always the money. It sounds boring, and I know it is kind of, you know, it's the open door. Money is, of course, donations are very helpful. Volunteering, which can be on different ways, doesn't need to be always physically, but can be as well like online. So it could be like grant writing, fundraisers, website maintenance, helping with social media, spreading the word.
Amazing. I will add all the links, as I said, including the link to donate the money, because it's boring, but it's the most important one. Deanna, thank you so much for everything that you shared on this episode. I really, really enjoyed it. And well, I will see you soon again. We live very close by, and I'm leaving Rio very soon, but I know I will be back because I share the same feeling of like, oh, this is my land somehow. So I'm sure I'll be back. But thank you so much, and we'll talk soon.
We talk soon. Thanks so much for this opportunity.